Chapter 17. The ships of the 63rd Expedition floated like a school of silver fish above the twin worlds of the Aurelian technocracy. Sharing a common moon, the space above them was alive with electronic chatter as the War Master's forces prosecuted the war below. Wrecked communication satellites were debris in the upper atmosphere, and what remained of the Aurelian monitors had long since plummeted as fiery meteors to the planet's surface. Fulgrim watched the slow drift of the War Master's ships above the second planet, their attention fixed on the conflict raging below, rather than their rear defences. He smiled as he realised that, if he was clever, he could catch his brother unawares.
"Slow to 1/4 flank speed," ordered Fulgrim. "All active systems to passive."
The bridge of the Pride of the Emperor throbbed with activity as its crew hurried to obey his orders. He kept his eyes glued to the readouts and hololithic projections of the surveyor station and issued fresh orders in response to each sensor sweep. Captain Eisel watched his every move with admiration. Fulgrim could just imagine the bitter envy that must fill any man who knew that he would never approach such genius. The 8-week journey to the Aurelian system had been one of enormous tedium for Fulgrim, with every diversion delighting him for only the briefest moment before becoming stale. He had even hoped for some catastrophe to occur in their warp translation, just for something to occupy his thoughts with some new sensation. But no such disaster had occurred. In preparation for his meeting with his beloved brother, Fulgrim's armour had been polished to a mirror sheen, the great golden eagle's wings sweeping high over his left shoulder. His armour had been restored to its familiar brilliant purple, edged in bright gold and inlaid with opalescent stones and gilded carvings. A long-scaled cloak was secured to his armour by silver brooches, and trailing parchments hung from his shoulder guards. He bore no weapon, and his hands continually itched to reach for his absent sword, to feel the reassuring heat of its silver grip, and the perversely comforting presence that spoke to him through Serena D'Angelis's masterpiece. Though he had not wielded Fireblade in many months, he missed even its balance and fiery edge. Without a weapon, especially the one torn from the Leia Temple, his thoughts were clearer, uncluttered by intrusive voices and treacherous thoughts. But, try as he might, he could not bring himself to forsake the weapon. The wounds he had suffered on Tarsus had healed, such that no observer would ever suspect the seriousness of them, and to commemorate his defeat of the Eldar god, a fresh mosaic had been created and hung in the central apothecarium of the Andronius. "Issue orders to all ships to disperse into attack formation at my order," whispered Fulgrim, as though the glinting specks of light before him might hear his words, were he to speak too loudly.
"Yes, my lord," said
Captain Eisel with a smile, though Fulgrim could see past his apparently genuine pleasure to the jealousy beyond. He returned his attention to the viewing bay, smiling to himself as he saw that Horus's fleet still had no idea that the entire 28th expedition was within striking distance. Fulgrim rested his hands on the command lectern as the enormity of his last thought settled on him. He could attack the War Master's expedition and destroy it utterly from here. His own warships were closing to the optimal firing distance, and he could unleash a devastating fusillade that would cripple the ability of the 63rd expedition to respond in any meaningful way. If Eldrad Ulthran had spoken the truth, then he could end the coming rebellion before it began.
"Plot firing solutions to the vessels before us," he ordered.
Within moments, the guns of the 28th Expedition were trained on the War Master's ships, and Fulgrim licked his lips as he realised that he wanted to open fire.
"My lord," said a voice beside him.
He turned to see Lord Commander Eidolon holding out his sheathed sword, the silver hilt gleaming in the low light of the bridge.
Fulgrim felt the dark, smothering weight of its presence settle upon him, and said, "Eidolon, you asked for your sword," said the Lord Commander. Fulgrim could not remember issuing the order, but nodded and resignedly reached out to take the proffered weapon. He looped it around his waist as though it was the most natural thing in the world, and as he snapped the golden eagle buckle closed, the desire to order the attack faded like morning mist. "Order all ships to unmask, but not to fire," he ordered. Captain Eisel leapt to obey, and Fulgrim watched as the fleet, before the 28th expedition, suddenly became aware of his ships and began to scatter, desperately trying to manoeuvre into a position where it could avoid being blasted to pieces. Fulgrim knew that the frantic change of formation was a fruitless endeavour, for his vessels were in the perfect attack formation and at the perfect firing range. The Vox system burst into life as dozens of hails were received from the 63rd expedition, and Fulgrim nodded as a channel was opened to the vengeful spirit, the Warmaster's flagship.
"Horus, my brother," said Fulgrim, "it seems I still have a thing or two to teach you."
Fulgrim marched across the docking umbilicus towards the sealed hatch leading to the vengeful spirit's upper transit dock. Lord Commander Eidolon walked beside him, and Apothecary Fabius, Saul Tarvitz, and the swordsman Lucius followed him. Fulgrim was disturbed to note that Lucius's face was heavily scarred with deep, parallel grooves. Many were fresh or recently healed, and he made a mental note to ask the warrior about them once their business with the 63rd expedition was concluded. He had chosen Tarvitz and Lucius because he had heard that they had forged friendships amongst the Lunar Wolves, and such associations were never to be overlooked. Eidolon accompanied him, for he feared for what Vespasian would make of what Horus might say in response to the allegations laid against him by the Council of Terror. As to why he had included Fabius, he wasn't sure, though he had a suspicion that the reason would be made clear to him soon enough. As he drew near the hatch, the eagle-stamped pressure door began to rise, and warm air and light rushed to fill the umbilicus. Setting his face in an expression of calm reserve, Fulgrim stepped onto the metal decking of the vengeful spirit. Horus was waiting for him, resplendent in gleaming armour of sea-green, with a brilliant amber eye at its centre. His brother's handsome patrician features were alive with simple pleasure at the sight of him, and Fulgrim felt his worries fade at the sight of the magnificent warrior before him. To imagine that Horus might plan some treachery against their father was ludicrous, and his love for his brother swelled in his breast. Four heroic specimens stood behind the Warmaster, who could only be the warriors that his brother called the Mournival. His trusted counsellors and advisers. Each was a warrior born and carried himself proudly erect. Fulgrim easily recognised Ezekiel Abaddon from his bellicose stance, familiar topknot and martial bearing. By the startling similarity between him and his Primarch, the warrior next to Abaddon could only be Horus Aximand, Little Horus. The remaining two he did not know, but each looked proud and noble, warriors to walk through the fire with. Fulgrim opened his arms, and the two Primarchs embraced like long-lost brothers.
"It has been too long, Horus," said Fulgrim.
"It has, my brother, it has," agreed Horus. "My heart sings to see you. But why are you here? You are prosecuting a campaign throughout the Perdus Anomaly. Is the region compliant already?"
"What worlds we found there are now compliant, yes," nodded Fulgrim as his retinue stepped through the pressure door behind him. Fulgrim could see the pleasure the Mournival took in seeing their familiar faces, and knew he had chosen his companions wisely. "I believe you are already familiar with some of my brothers, Tarvitz, Lucius, and Lord Commander Eidolon, but I do not believe you have met Chief Apothecary Fabius."
"It is an honour to meet you, Lord Horus,"
said Fabius, bowing low. Horace acknowledged the gesture of respect and said,
"Come now, Fulgrim, you know better than to try and stall me. What's so important that you turn up unannounced and give half my crew heart attacks?"
The smile fell from Fulgrim's lips, and he said,
"There have been reports, Horace."
"Reports? What does that mean?"
"Reports that things are not as they should be,"
he replied, hating that he had to bring the petty concerns of scribes and notaries to his brother's notice.
"Reports that suggest you and your warriors should be called to account for the brutality of this campaign. Is Angron up to his usual tricks?"
"Angron is as he has always been."
"That bad?"
"No. I keep him on a short leash, and his equerry, Khan, seems to curb the worst of our brother's excesses."
"Then I have arrived just in time."
"I see," said Horace. "Are you here to relieve me?"
Fulgrim forced himself to conceal the horror he felt that his brother could conceive of such a thing, and covered his consternation with a laugh.
"Relieve you?" he said. "No, my brother, I am here so that I can return and tell those fops and scribes on Terra that Horus fights war the way it is meant to be fought, hard, fast, and cruel."
"War is cruelty. There is no use trying to reform it. The crueler it is, the sooner it is over."
Fulgrim nodded and said,
"Indeed, my brother. Come, there is much for us to talk about, for we are living in strange times. It seems our brother Magnus has once again done something to upset the Emperor, and the Wolf of Fenris has been unleashed to escort him back to Terra."
"Magnus?" asked Horace, suddenly serious. "What has he done?"
"Let us talk of it in private," said Fulgrim,
desiring to end this public airing of such filthy accusations.
"Anyway, I have a feeling my subordinates would welcome the chance to reacquaint themselves with your, what do you call it, Mournival?"
"Yes," smiled Horace. "Memories of murder, no doubt."
Horace indicated that Fulgrim should walk with him, and the two Primarchs marched from the transit deck.
Eidolon followed in his footsteps, while Abaddon and Horace Aximand fell in behind the War Master. But Fulgrim could not fail to notice the accusing looks the Lunar Wolves threw in the Lord Commander's direction. Fulgrim wondered what had passed between the warriors on murder as Horus led him through the halls of the mighty ship towards his personal staterooms. Horus spoke volubly of shared memories of more innocent times, when all that had been before them was the simple joy of warfare. But Fulgrim heard none of it, too locked in his own private misery to listen. At last the journey ended at a pair of simple darkwood doors, and Horace dismissed the two members of his Mournival. Fulgrim likewise dismissed Eidolon, ordering him to attend upon Apothecary Fabius. "In many ways it is fortuitous that you come to me now, my brother," said Horace.
"How so?"
asked Fulgrim, as the War Master opened the doors and stepped inside.
Horace did not answer, and Fulgrim followed him, seeing that an Astartes in armour the colour of weathered granite awaited them.
The warrior was powerfully built, and his battle plate was bedecked with parchments and tightly curled script work. His head was shaven bare, the skin covered in angular tattoos.
"This is Erebus of the Word Bearers," said Horace. "And you are correct."
"About what?"
asked Fulgrim.
"That we have much to talk about," said Horace, closing the doors.
Horace's staterooms were Spartan and austere compared to his own, without the lush decorations and fine artworks that hung on every wall and stood proud on golden plinths. This did not surprise Fulgrim, for his brother had always eschewed personal comforts in favour of appearing to share the discomforts of his warriors. Beyond an archway veiled in white silk, he could see his brother's personal chambers, and he smiled as he saw the mighty desk there, the piles of oath papers strewn across its surface, and the tome of astrology given to Horus by their father. Thinking of their father,
Fulgrim looked over to the wall upon which was painted a mural he had not seen in decades. It depicted the Emperor ascendant over all, with his hands outstretched, and above him spun constellations of stars.
"I remember that being painted," said Fulgrim wistfully.
"Many years ago now," agreed Horus, pouring wine from a silver ewer and handing the goblet to him.
The wine was deep red, and Fulgrim felt as though he was staring into an ocean of blood as he raised it to his lips and took a long draught. Oily sweat bristled on his brow. Fulgrim glanced over at the seated figure of Erebus and felt an irrational dislike for the word-bearer, despite never having met him or heard a single word pass his lips. He had never particularly relished the company of Lorgar or the warriors of the 17th Legion, finding their enthusiasms unwholesome and their former zeal in proclaiming the Emperor as a figure of worship contrary to the central tenets of the Great Crusade.
"Tell me of Lorgar," ordered Fulgrim. "It has been some time since I have seen him. He prospers?"
"He does indeed," smiled Erebus, "like never before."
Fulgrim frowned at the warrior's choice of words and sat down on the couch facing the War Master's desk. The War Master sliced the flesh of an apple with a gleaming serpent-hilted dagger, and Fulgrim's rarefied senses could feel an unspoken tension in the air, a miasma of things unsaid and great potential. Whatever Horus had in mind was clearly something of great import.
"You have recovered well from your wounds," noted Fulgrim, catching the furtive glance shared between the War Master and Erebus. Precious little information had been released from the 63rd Expedition regarding the Davin campaign, certainly nothing to indicate that Horus had been wounded, but the War Master's reaction proved that at least part of the Farseer's tale was true.
"You heard about that?" said Horus, taking a slice of apple into his mouth and wiping the juice from his chin with the back of his hand.
"I did," nodded Fulgrim.
Horus shrugged.
"I attempted to prevent word of it reaching the other expeditions for fear of the damage it might do to morale. It was nothing, a minor wound to the shoulder."
Fulgrim smelled a lie and said,
"Really? I heard that you were dying."
The War Master's eyes narrowed.
"Who told you that?"
"It doesn't matter," said Fulgrim. "What's important is that you survived."
"Yes, I survived. And now I am stronger than ever, revitalized even."
Fulgrim raised his glass and said, "Then let us give thanks for such a speedy recovery."
Horus drank to mask his annoyance, and Fulgrim let a small smile creep across his face at the thrill of antagonizing so powerful a being as the War Master.
"So," began Horus, changing the subject, "you have been sent to check up on me, is that it? Is my competence as War Master in question?"
Fulgrim shook his head.
"No, my brother. Though there are those who question your means of advancing the Great Crusade. Civilians, light years from the battles we fight in their name, dare question how you make war, and seek to exploit our brotherhood by tasking me to bring your war dogs to heel."
"By war dogs, I assume you mean Angron."
Fulgrim nodded and took a drink of the bitter wine.
"It cannot have escaped your notice that he is a far from subtle weapon. Personally, I do not favour his employment in theatres of war, where anything less than total destruction is called for, but I recognise that there are times for subtlety and times for raw aggression. Is this war such a time?"
"It is," promised Horus. "Angron bloodies himself for me, and at this moment I need him drenched in blood."
"Why?"
"I'm sure you remember what Angron was like after Ulanor, Fulgrim," asked Horus. "He raged against my appointment like a caged animal. His every utterance was calculated to belittle me in the eyes of those who thought my being named War Master an insult to their pride."
"Angron thinks with his sword arm, not his head," said Fulgrim. "I remember that it took all my skill in diplomacy to calm the thunder in his heart and smooth his ruffled pride, but he accepted your role. Grudgingly, it has to be said, but he accepted it."
"Grudgingly is not good enough," stated Horus flatly. "If I am to be War Master, I must have utter devotion and total obedience from all those I command in the days of blood to come. I am giving Angron what he wants, allowing him to affirm his loyalty to me in the only way he knows how. Where others would pull tight the chain that binds him, I allow him his head."
"And his loyalty to you is forged anew in blood," said Fulgrim.
"Just so," agreed Horus.
"I believe that is what the Council of Terra objects to."
"I am the War Master, and I make use of the tools available to me, moulding them to fit my purpose," said Horus. "Our brother Angron is raw and bloody, but he has his place in my designs. That place requires that his loyalty, first and foremost, is to me."
Fulgrim watched the War Master's eyes as he spoke, seeing a passionate fervour he had not seen in many decades. His brother spoke of magniloquent designs, and the fact that he required utter devotion from his followers. Was this the treachery the Farseer had spoken of? As Angron's loyalty was being won, was Horus swaying others to his cause? Fulgrim stole a glance at Erebus, seeing that he too was enraptured by the War Master's words, and wondered who laid first claim to the loyalties of the Word-Bearer's Primarch.
"Patience. In time these truths will be known," said the voice in his head. "You have always looked up to Horus. Trust him now, for your destiny is linked inextricably with his."
He caught a sudden startled furrowing of Erebus's brow and experienced a moment's panic as he wondered if the Word-Bearer had heard the voice too. Fulgrim pushed aside such concerns and nodded at Horus's words.
"I understand perfectly," he said.
"I see," said Horus. "And the Council's concern is simply with Angron's bloodlust?"
"Not entirely," he replied. "As I said, the Wolf of Fenris has been dispatched to Prospero in order to bring Magnus back to Terra, though for what purpose I do not know."
"He has been practicing sorcery," said Erebus. Fulgrim felt a spike of anger enter his heart at the warrior's temerity in addressing a Primarch without a direct question being asked of him. "Who are you to speak without leave in the presence of your betters?" he demanded, turning to Horus and waving a dismissive hand at the Word-Bearer. "Who is this warrior anyway, and tell me why he joins our private discussions?"
"Erebus is an advisor to me," said Horus, "a valued counsellor and aid."
"Your Mournival is not enough for you?" asked Fulgrim.
"Times have changed, my brother, and I have set plans in motion for which the Council of the Mournival is not appropriate, matters to which they cannot yet be made privy. Well, not all of them, at any rate," he added with a pained smile.
"What matters?" asked Fulgrim.
But Horus shook his head.
"In time, my brother. In time," promised Horus, rising from behind his desk and circling it to stand before the mural of the Emperor. "Tell me more of Magnus and his transgressions."
Fulgrim shrugged.
"You now know as much as I, Horus. All I was given to understand, I have now told you."
"Nothing of substance as to how Magnus is to travel to Terra, as a penitent or a supplicant?"
"I do not know," admitted Fulgrim, "though to send one who dislikes Magnus as much as the wolf to fetch him home suggests that he does not travel to Terra to be honoured."
"It does not," agreed Horus, and Fulgrim could see a glimmer of relief ghost across his brother's face.
Had Magnus, like Eldrad Ulthran, seen a glimpse of the future and attempted to give warning of an imminent betrayal? If so, the War Master would need to deal with him before his return to Terra. With the matter of the Lord of Prospero dispensed with, to his apparent satisfaction, the War Master nodded in the direction of the mural and said,
"You said you remembered this being made."
Fulgrim nodded, and the War Master continued.
"So do I, vividly. You and I, we had just felled the last of the Omakad princes aboard their observatory world, and the Emperor decided that such a victory should be remembered.
While the Emperor smote the last of their princes, you slew their king and took his head for the Museum of Conquest," said Fulgrim.
"As you say," nodded Horus, tapping a finger against the painting. "I slew their king. And yet it is the Emperor who holds the constellations of the galaxy in his grip. Where are the murals that show the honours you and I won that day, my friend?"
"Jealousy," chuckled Fulgrim. "I knew you thought highly of yourself, but I never expected to see such vanity."
Horus shook his head.
"No, my brother, it is not vanity to wish your deeds and achievements recognized. Who among us has a greater tally of victory than I? Who among us was chosen to act as War Master? Only I was judged worthy, and yet the only honours I possess are those I fashion for myself."
"In time, when the crusade is over, you will be lauded for your actions," said Fulgrim.
"Time," snapped Horus. "Time is the one thing we do not have. In essence, we may be aware that the galaxy revolves in the heavens, but we do not perceive it, and the ground upon which we walk seems not to move. Mortal men can live out their lives undisturbed by such lofty concepts, but they will never achieve greatness by inaction and ignorance. So it is with time, my brother. Unless we stop and take its measure, the opportunity for perfect glory will slip away from us before we even realize that it was there."
The words of the Eldar seer echoed in his head as though shouted in his ear.
"He will lead his armies against your emperor."
Horus locked his gaze with him, and Fulgrim felt the fires of his brother's purpose surge like an electric current in the room, feeding the flames of his own obsessive need for perfection. As horrified as he was by the things he was hearing, he could not deny a powerful force of attraction swelling within him at the thought of joining his brother. He saw the rampant ambition and yearning for power that drove Horus, and understood that his brother desired to hold the stars in his grip, as the Emperor did upon the mural.
"Everything you have been told is true."
Fulgrim leaned back in his chair and drained the last of his wine.
"Tell me of this perfect glory," he said.
Horus and Erebus spoke for 3 days, telling Fulgrim of what had befallen the 63rd expedition on Davin, of the treachery of Yugan Temba, the assault on the crashed glory of Terra, and the necrotic possession that had taken his flesh. Horus spoke of a weapon known as the Anathame, which was brought to his staterooms by Fulgrim's apothecary after he had handed Fabius his seal to have it removed from the vengeful spirit's Medicaid deck. Fulgrim saw that the sword was a crude thing, its blade like stone-worked obsidian, a dull grey filled with a glittering sheen like diamond flint. Its hilt was made of gold and was of superior workmanship to the blade, though still primitive in comparison to Fireblade, or even the silver sword of the Lair. Horus then told him the truth of his injury, how he had indeed almost died, but for the diligence and devotion of his legion's quiet order. Of his time in the Delphos, the massive temple structure on Davin, he said little, save that his eyes had been opened to great truths, and the monstrous deception that had been perpetrated upon them. All through this retelling, Fulgrim had felt a creeping horror steal across him, a formless dread of the words that were undermining the very bedrock of his beliefs. He had heard the warning of the Eldar seer, but until this moment he had not believed that such a thing could be true. He wanted to deny the War Master's words, but each time he tried to speak, a powerful force within him urged him to keep his counsel, to listen to his brother's words.
The Emperor has lied to us, Fulgrim, said Horus,
and Fulgrim felt a knot of hurt anger uncoil in his gut at such an utterance.
He means to abandon us to the wilderness of the galaxy while he ascends to godhood.
Fulgrim felt as though his muscles were locked in a steel vice, for surely he should have flown at Horus to strike him down for such a treacherous utterance. Instead, he sat stunned as he felt his limbs tremble and his entire world collapsed. How could Horus, most worthy of Primarchs, be saying such things? No matter that he had heard them before from different mouths, the substance of their reality had been meaningless until now. To see Horus's lips form words of rebellion kept him rooted to his chair in horrified disbelief. Horus was his most trusted friend, and long ago they had sworn in blood never to speak an untruth to one another. With such an oath between them, Fulgrim had to believe that either his father or his brother had lied to him.
You have no choice. Join with Horus, or all you have striven for will have been in vain.
No, he managed to whisper, tears welling in his eyes. The anticipation of this moment had fired his senses, but the reality of it was proving to be very different indeed.
Yes, said Horus, his expression pained but determined. We believed the Emperor to be the ultimate embodiment of perfection, Fulgrim, but we were wrong. He is not perfect. He is just a man, and we strove to emulate his lie.
All my life, I wanted to be like him, said Fulgrim.
As did we all, my brother, said Horus. It pains me to say these things to you, but they must be said, for a time of war is coming. Nothing can prevent that, and I need my closest brothers beside me when the time comes to purge our legions of those who will not follow us.
Fulgrim looked up through tear-rimmed eyes and said, You are wrong, Horus. You must be wrong. How could an imperfect being have wrought the likes of us?
Us, said Horus. We are but the instruments of his will to achieve dominance of the galaxy before his ascension. When the wars are over, we will be cast aside, for we are flawed creations, fashioned from the wide womb of uncreated night. Even before our births, the Emperor cast us aside when he could have saved us. You remember the nightmare of Chemos, the wasteland it was when you fell to its blasted hinterlands? The pain you suffered there? The pain we all suffered on the planets where we grew to manhood? All of that could have been avoided. He could have stopped it all, but he cared so little for us that he simply let it happen. I saw it happen, my brother. I saw it all.
How? Gasped Fulgrim. How could you have seen such things?
In my near-death state, I was granted an epiphany of hindsight, said Horus. Whether I saw the past or simply had my earliest memories unlocked, I do not know, but what I experienced was as real to me as you are.
The grey meat of Fulgrim's brain was filling fit to burst as he sought to process all that Horus was telling him.
Even in my moments of blackest doubt, all that sustained me was the utter certainty of my ultimate achievement of perfection, said Fulgrim. The Emperor was the shining paragon of that dream's attainment, and to have that taken away from me...
Doubt is not a pleasant condition, nodded Horus, but certainty is absurd when it is built on a lie.
Fulgrim felt his mind reel, that he even entertained the possibility that Horus could be right, his words unravelling all that he had ever been and all he had ever hoped to achieve. His past was gone, destroyed to feed his father's lie, and all that was left to him was his future.
The Emperor is a comedian playing to an audience too afraid to laugh, said Horus.
To him we are tools to be used until blunted and then cast aside. Why else would he leave us and the crusade to retreat to his dungeons beneath terror? His apotheosis is already underway, and it is up to us to stop it.
I dreamed of one day being like him, whispered Fulgrim, of standing at his shoulder and feeling his pride and love for me.
Horace stepped forward, kneeling before him and taking his hands.
All men dream, Fulgrim, but not all men dream equally. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find that it was vanity. For men like us, the dreamers of the day, our dreams are ones of hope, of improvement, of change. Perhaps we were once simply weapons, warriors who knew nothing beyond the art of death, but we have grown, my brother. We are so much more than that now, but the Emperor does not see it. He would abandon his greatest achievements to the darkness of a hostile universe. I know this for a fact, Fulgrim, for I did not simply receive this wisdom. I discovered it for myself after a journey that no one could take for me or spare me.
I cannot hear this, Horace, cried Fulgrim, surging to his feet as his flesh threw off the paralysis that had thus far held him immobile. He marched towards the mural of the Emperor and shouted, You have no idea what you are asking me to do.
On the contrary, replied Horace, rising to follow him, I know exactly what I am asking you to do. I am asking you to stand with me, to defend our birthright. This galaxy is ours by right of conquest and blood. But it is to be given away to grubby politicians and clerks. I know you have seen this, and it must make your blood boil as it does mine. Where were those civilians when it was our warriors dying by the thousand? Where were they when we crossed the span of the galaxy to bring illumination to the lost fragments of humanity? I'll tell you where. They huddled in their dark and dusty halls and penned diatribes like this.
Horace reached down to his desk, snatched up a handful of papers, and thrust them into Fulgrim's hands.
What are these? He asked.
Lies, said Horace. They call it the Lectitio Divinitatis, and it is spreading through the fleets like a virus. It is a cult that deifies the Emperor and openly worships him as a god. Can you believe it? After all we have done to bring the light of science and reason to these pathetic mortals, they invent a false god and turn to him for guidance.
A god?
Aye, Fulgrim, a god, said Horace, his anger spilling out in a surge of violence. The War Master roared and hammered his fist into the mural, his gauntlet smashing the painted face of the Emperor to shards of cracked stone.
Ruptured blocks fell from the wall to crash upon the metal deck, and Fulgrim released the papers he held, watching them flutter to the floor amid the ruin of the mural. Fulgrim cried out as his world shattered into shards as fragmented as the rubble of the mural, his love for the Emperor torn from his breast and held up for the dirty, useless thing it was. Horace came to him and cupped his face in his hands, staring into his eyes with an intensity that was almost fanatical.
I need you, my brother, pleaded Horace. I cannot do this without you. But you must do nothing against your conscience. My brother, my phoenix, my hope, wing your way through the darkness and defy fortune's spite. Revive from the ashes and rise.
Fulgrim met his brother's stare.
What would you have me do?